This is January. It is cold, it is dark, and it's bleak. But there is a lot of great art stuff lighting up this town right now. And today on KCUR Central Standard, we're going to talk about three exciting things going on this month. Two gallery exhibits and one big dance party to get your blood pumping in the dead of winter. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we will start this show with Los Angeles-based artist Aaron Rinkel. Aaron used to live in Kansas City. He came here to attend the Art Institute, and he was a rising star in the art scene when he decided to pack his bags and head to Southern California. He's taken LA's conceptual art scene by storm. He's been featured in all the arty blogs out there. He's friends with famous artists, and he's kind of a fixture in LA's Chinatown. He's had shows written up in the New York Times and other major publications. But maybe it's fitting that his first ever museum show is here in Kansas City. He's one of a handful of artists featured in Pulse at the Nerman Museum. Aaron Rinkel, welcome home, by phone anyway.
Oh, thanks so much, Gina.
So
thank you. You had to mention I packed my bags.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't just go. You packed them.
No. But it's an honor to be coming back to Kansas City. It's really a homecoming in a sense. So thank you so much.
You know, I do want to back up a little. When you lived here, you were this promising, but I hope you don't mind my saying, kind of lost young guy. I used to serve you coffee and kind of informally advise you on what to do with your life because you were very conflicted about whether to stay here or move away. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I think that has a lot to say, not necessarily just about me. I mean, I will acknowledge something on that, but it has to do with the times. You know, we're living in, like, right at the edge of the end of the Bush administration, and, you know, it was a conflicting time, but mostly I was feeling the sense of needing to expand as an artist, and I knew what it was going to take to do that, and I haven't thought about it a day since I left. I miss Kansas City terribly. I love that community. It's the reason why I am who I am as an artist. I mean, I learned all of my training as a painter at the Kansas City Art Institute, and I learned my first kind of sense of community through Kansas City. So, and you were part of that. You served me coffee and breakfast at YJ's.
It's true.
But you gave me advice too. So
you grew up in Springfield, Missouri, and then moved to Kansas City. And I can't help but assume that your ideas of LA before moving there came through that lens and came from pop culture, probably, like from the TV screen and the movie screen. Did LA match your expectations when you got there?
Not at all. I mean, it was very dated. You're exactly right. I learned about LA through MTV and the Real World, but also through the subculture of skateboarding. I knew, growing up, skateboarding and art were my kind of, punk kind of, that was my mode of expression to kind of rebel. So I knew that existed, but when I got out here, it was way different. I mean, there are those things, but everyone's gotten old, and everyone's still wearing the same type of clothing. Actually, it's not like as high fashion as you would think it would be. I mean, and people get stuck in kind of their generational kind of fixtures, you know.
Can you explain that a little more? Like every generation, like. Is it like there are different generations who are all kind of stuck in their moments in LA?
Well, I didn't expect to still find people listening to Sublime. I mean, you might like Sublime, but I personally, I didn't think coming out here, I'd find people wearing like the same, like those big JNCO pants or like just being, it's fine. People are just comfortable kind of in their niches, and so it kind of makes sense for me, because coming out here as a painter, even though I wasn't painting a whole lot when I came to LA, I found myself back in my own niche, and
skateboarding.
I do roll around sometimes, but back to it was my what would it be, post-adolescent Nietzsche, and that was being a very romantic painter, like the idea of like getting up every morning and painting, and that's where I'm at. But I mean, I could do that anywhere at this point. So I mean, but it's basically doing the same thing I did when I was in Kansas City.
Your big breakout moment in LA seems to have been, I mean, this is what everyone talks to you about, but it seems to have been a performance of restoring a 77 Volvo. But you actually restored it with your dad. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, everyone wants to talk about that, and I don't mind touching a little base on that. It's just that was a piece I did right out of grad school, and it just happened to be that the car was originally owned by Douglas Hubler, who's a highly regarded was a highly regarded still as conceptual artist photographer who taught, you know, all of my heroes, Mike Kelly, Tony Oersler, Jim Shaw. And this car was just sitting out back behind the wood shop, just completely defaced. And I just was at a point where I, again, like what you brought up initially, questioning my position, kind of feeling lost. School was getting ready to end. I wondered if I made the right choice. And I reached back home, and I got my dad to come out, and we spent probably the best time that we'd ever spent together as like father and son, and we rebuilt this car. We did the body work on it, and we painted it, and unfortunately the motor was just so gone that it I mean, it was an old 77 Volvo, so
You
I
know,
don't know if I think you might have driven a Volvo.
no, but I wish. Can I tell you, like, I'm curious about your dad. I mean, can you tell me where he was coming from on this project? Like, what's his history with restoring cars? I'm curious whether he found it funny that this was being called art.
I think, well, yeah, he totally did, but I think in a lot of ways it was the first time that we ever understood that there was a relationship kind of equivalent to me as being an artist per se. It is a more practical approach, and my father's an auto refinisher, so I grew up seeing cars that were dismantled and crumpled up being restored to, you know, impeccable condition. So in a lot of ways I always found that to be equivalent to the art history that I saw growing up, because I saw this history of kind of hodgepodge, ad hoc, kind of Rauschenbergian aesthetics, and then it went to this high modern kind of fetish finish, and then into push pull kind of minimalist abstraction, where that's where I really learned things. So in a lot of ways we turn this kind of historic object into a new thing, and so we painted it, but it was still kind of a facade, you know, just like all things are. But yeah, it was a great experience, and yeah, I mean, he's still rebuilding cars.
I've read some of what you've been up to in LA, but honestly, a lot of it
Uh-oh.
is so specific to LA that it is somewhat hard to follow from here, just not really knowing that world. Like, I've read about a project where you like rehabbed a pond in Chinatown.
Yeah, I mean, well, I've been in Chinatown now about a decade, so I've become familiar. I've tried to step back a little bit because, like in most cities, gentrification is starting to affect people, and people are getting upset. So I don't want to be this kind of Midwestern white guy that comes in and tries to, you know, look like I'm telling people how to fix things. But I had the opportunity to, and I have had the opportunity to paint buildings through communication with the elders at their invitation, and it's a great community. So I just went in and moved around some figurines and stuff that they had given me to put in there, and I cleaned it out. But it just happened to be in proximity, across the street from the famous wishing well, the Mike Kelly kind of famously remade, painstakingly remade the whole fountain which I believe MoCA Los Angeles owns.
You know,
So yeah.
The show that's bringing you home to the Nerman includes your paintings.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's got paintings in it. And so you come from this painting background, and then you went out and did like a lot of performative stuff and like conceptual stuff, we'll say. And now you're back to painting, as you've mentioned. And the show at the Nerman is about how different painters use the human figure to communicate about emotion or politics or social issues. Yours seem to be in the emotion camp.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of reading over some of the writings on the other artists, and I don't know all the artists very well, but I did get a sense from what I've seen and been reading that, you know, all of us kind of seem to build these relationships between like varying techniques that are juxtaposed with figuration. And, you know, for example, like Ronald Jackson, he uses this like floral masking, and it's, you know, it,
he shows faces with masks in front of them.
Yeah. And it's like, and from my understanding, through his own statement, it's kind of this portrayal of a mirroring or a reflection as a concept. And that's a concept that I can get really behind, at this thing that makes a work appealing to the viewer, but it's also a mirroring of the self. So, yeah, emotional, like, yeah, I'm not afraid at all anymore to admit that, as I feel like a matured artist and painter. But so, for example,
wait, can you back up on that? Why would someone be afraid to admit that their paintings are about emotion, express emotion?
Well, that would be a whole other segment. But coming from the school of like Cal Arts, that was a real eye opener for me, to be relocated in a completely foreign situation in a school. Even though I was already examining performance art, objecthood, and stuff like that, but to have this notion that in a way that I needed to repress my content of emotion and individuality, which I've been taught so well at the Kansas City Art Institute to do, it was agonizing to me. So anyway, so my painting. One of the main paintings that I like to look at is kind of a placeholder in that, in my body of work at the Nerman, which I haven't seen the show yet. I'm very excited. Is a large, it's actually a self-portrait, but it looks more like a Morris Lewis swathing of color that's saturated into the raw canvas. Well, before I laid those gestures down, there was a illustrative self-portrait. I had this
I know
idea.
What you're talking about, and I'll let you explain the idea. But for people who aren't familiar with the artist you're referencing, this it looks.
Yes.
If you were to look at it, just walk into the gallery, what you see are big swaths of very bright, high contrast color. They're not like lined up, sort of. I guess geometrically, like it's not like straight lines and clear cut divisions between the colors. They're sort of like, it's a little bit looser and a little bit more organic looking, like sort of, yeah, but there are big, high contrast, bright colors, pink, things like that, yellow.
Yeah, they're kind of like Frankenfellers, but like they overlap and they're a little bit brighter, you know.
And then under that, like, you see like the ghost of a face, and it's you don't see it right at first. You see it as you approach it. And then there are like tabs, I would say like almost like tabs sticking off, like things that go past the rectangle of the canvas that are like just sticking off on the sides.
Well, that's another.
Oh, that was a different one. Sorry.
That's another painting, but it's painted in the same manner. But so the large piece is a portrait, and the idea is that I'm kind of looking out over the works. But again, it goes back to like that same notion that I was kind of talking about with Ronald Jackson's work. Of this, like, they're vastly different bodies of work, but I think that's what Bruce and his team did
Bruce
so
Hartman,
well.
Bruce Hartman, the curator.
Yeah, that's what they did so well of connecting all these artists, because everyone between Have Karaman, you know, these examples of Iranian, or I'm sorry, Iraqi women, and these kind of issues of immigration, and but you could almost see those paintings like at the Nelson Atkins or something. I used to work there actually right out of school, and it reminds me of like old Japanese screens or things like that, or you know.
Aaron,
And all of, yeah.
I hate to jump in here, but we're running short on time, and I have one more thing I really want to ask you. So I hope that
Okay,
people will
yes.
go and
Yeah.
see those paintings. But you've talked about this as a homecoming, like a Kansas City homecoming. But you actually
Yeah.
do come back to Missouri a lot. You spend time in Springfield, where you keep a second studio, actually, in a retired pig barn on your parents' land. Can you tell me the significance of that in your life and your art now that you're this LA art fixture?
First and foremost, and I hope I've made sense throughout this. I get a little long-winded. First
You've
and
done great.
foremost, I am still just a country boy in a sense. You know, I am a Midwestern. I still consider myself a Midwestern artist. You know, I have came out to L.A. da 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 da. But to find a like I said, I can make my paintings anywhere now, and to come back. Visit my family, which is more and more important. The older I get, the older they get. And honestly, when I come to Missouri, I'm so free. I don't have any restraints. I use my dad's paint, and it's just great. And I get to spend time with them and make work.
Aaron Rinkel, it's
And
been
it's,
so good to catch up with you. Thank you so much.
thank you so much, and I can't wait to see Kansas City.
Aaron is one of several artists in the show Pulse at the Nerman. It just opened, and there will be an artist talk with Aaron and some of the other artists on January 31st. Learn more at nermanmuseum.org. Up next, your last chance to hit the Church of the Crossroads with Renee Stout. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and tonight is your last chance to hit the Church of the Crossroads, a show with work created over decades by Renee Stout. If you don't know who she is, let me start by saying that this year, the Women's Caucus of Art gave her the Lifetime Achievement Award. Previous recipients include people like Georgia O'Keeffe. So this is a big time situation. Renee is 60, and the Belgers in Kansas City have been collecting her work since she was in her late 20s. So the show they've got right now follows her career from early self-portraits to sculptures of guns, we'll talk about that later, collections of vials containing potions and roots, tools of the trade for the artist's alter ego, a kind of fortune teller or voodoo priestess. Crosses and bones make a recurring appearance throughout her work, and I am really excited to talk to her about all of it today. Renee Stout, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
First of all, congratulations on that Lifetime Achievement Award.
Thank you.
This show in Kansas City is called The Church of the Crossroads. Can you tell me what that title means to you?
Yeah, basically, because I'm African American, I have been, you know, researching, you know, my roots and history, you know, for a good bit of my artistic career, I realized that there's the concept in some African cultures of the crossroads. And it's a place where supposedly the moral plane meets the spiritual plane, and you can communicate with the ancestors to seek guidance in your life. So the idea of that concept really appealed to me because, as a person, you know, living in the world that we live in, you know, I'm constantly seeking, you know, guidance from the ancestors to help me make the right choices in life to get through and navigate everything that, you know, we face as human beings every day. So that's why the crossroads is a recurring theme in my work, because as a, you know, as a person, I'm always at a crossroads. And then, like right now, our country is at a crossroads. So it's almost like a theme that I can't escape right now.
One of the self-portraits I mentioned says that your mom knew you'd be an artist from the moment you started drawing on your shoes. And I understand you were really, really little when that happened. Can you tell me more about, like, how you grew up and how art entered the picture besides the shoes?
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I was like 3 years old, and I had a pair of Buster Brown, which is a brand of shoes. I don't know if they still make them. And they were Mary Janes, and I'd taken one of my mother's ink pens and scribbled on the toes. And instead of her getting upset about it, she realized that, you know, I wanted to make marks. So she started supplying me with all kinds of things to create with, you know, sketchbooks, paint, you know. And I think that she recognized my impulse to be, you know, an artist, because she had a brother when she was growing up that was a self-taught artist. He had never gone to art school or anything like that. And all he liked to do was draw all the time. So I think she recognized those same patterns in me and, you know, the things that I was interested in. So she was a big part in sort of nurturing that, you know, spark of creativity.
I understand that you grew up in the Catholic Church. And you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but voodoo symbols are such a big part of your work. And I'm curious how you kind of made that transition in your life or where that fascination plays into your story.
Well, you know, I didn't actually grow up in the Catholic Church because my parents didn't really go to church when I was growing up, but they really, you know, I could tell you, they were really spiritual people, taught us a sense of right and wrong and a sense of a higher power, but they didn't really define it for us. My paternal grandmother was Baptist and my maternal grandmother was Catholic. So they allowed us to go to church with both grandmothers. So I had, you know, the experience in both churches. And then when I got older, you know, I asked my parents why they never forced us to go to church. And they said that they felt that religion was something that should be a choice and not something forced on you. And I thought that was amazing. And so, you know, when I started researching, you know, my African-American history, I realized that, you know, there were so many interesting concepts in various African religions. And I also recognized that in the African diaspora, those original religions were transformed when they were combined with other religions. And so when I discovered, like, voodoo in New Orleans and hoodoo in New Orleans and how the Haitian voodoo, what they do in their religions, I realized that it was a combination of a lot of Catholic beliefs with some original, you know, African beliefs in various African cultures where the slaves had come from. So I became very interested in those combinations of religions. That's how I arrived at where I am now.
Tell me about your alter ego.
Well, her name was Fatima Mayfield, and it was a combination of names brought together by two women that I, you know, lived in my Washington, D.C. neighborhood. And I had become fascinated in my studies by women who were seers or fortune tellers or root women who worked with roots and herbs to create remedies for the community, who sometimes couldn't afford, you know, health care. In, you know, rural communities, they would, you know, they knew herbs and the benefits of herbs, and so they would prescribe these things. And also they would become these sort of advisors, you know, for people who were going through issues and that kind of thing. So the idea of creating an alter ego that was this kind of person that served her community was an interesting role to play, because it became a long-running narrative in my work, this character. So it was like I was acting out this story, and the works that I made became the prop, you know, like the sort of props or the objects in this long-running narrative.
Yeah, okay. I want to talk about one of these objects. There is a voodoo keyboard in one of your installations, and it looks at first glance like a found object, like someone just like was getting rid of a keyboard and you grabbed it or something. But it is clearly not, because as you look closely at it, where the keys on my keyboard will say things like caps lock and shift, mm-hmm. yours say things like past, present, and future. And in fact, the like Roman or the characters, the letters on our keyboards, they're symbols mm-hmm. that many of us wouldn't recognize, but you clearly know what they are. It is hard to tell in your work, actually, mm-hmm. what you found and what you made. Like, is the bone a bone or did you make a bone? That kind of thing.
Well, that's part of the game for me, because I started off as a realist painter. And when I transitioned into sculpture, I realized that need to create a sort of illusion that something, you know, is like real on a two-dimensional surface, like I used to do in painting, it then, you know, that sort of transformed into me trying to create objects sometimes to fool the viewer into wondering what object did I find and add to the piece, and what object did I make to add to the piece.
What do you think you're really playing with there?
Just, you know, my own skills, trying to see if I can make somebody, fool somebody into believing that something I created was something that I actually found.
And it's almost like there is a little bit of a magic in that that gets back to the idea of someone who might have a potion that can do something magical.
Exactly, exactly. It's all about, to me, in my mindset, conjuring something, you know. That's what I do in my studio. It's like, to me, it's this whole sense of play and, you know, I approach my work with a sense of humor no matter what kind of emotions I'm dealing with. I always kind of approach it with that, the wonder of that same 3 or 4 year old that, you know, just wanted to create things.
But, okay, so speaking of no matter what the emotions are, there are a few, like, I guess, categories of, I would say, darkness that I want to talk about. One is that there are a lot of references to men facing the truth, and especially in some of these self-portraits, there are like, there'll be the image of you, and then above and below, like, almost like comic book frames, you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? With
yep.
little flashes, almost like the way you might remember something, and a lot of those memories, I would say, are a little bit dark, and I'm sure very personal, but they mm-hmm. hint at difficult chapters in your dealings with men.
Yes. Yeah, because, you know, as a, you know, all of us have had relationships, and, you know, sometimes there are ups and sometimes there are downs. Sometimes we've made bad choices. And I know exactly one of the pieces that you're referring to. I mean, mm-hmm. I've done a series, but I know specifically one that you're talking about. And that was a particularly difficult sort of chapter in my life. And I was processing everything through that piece. So that's how the work functions for me sometimes. It's like I reflect on, you know, what was going on and, you know, trying to work through it. And making artwork about it sometimes makes me, you know, really have to go inside and focus and process. So it's kind of cathartic when I make a piece like that. And even though, you know, it could be painful at the time, you know, with some time, I can look back on that piece and kind of smile at the results of my process.
You know, you mentioned that you used to do photorealistic paintings and paintings that depicted sort of like realistic scenes from your neighborhood. And I understand that this major shift kind of happened in your work when a young guy in his early 20s who hung out around your studio was killed.
Yeah, I would say that the shift was already happening because I was a realist painter when I lived in Pittsburgh. And when I shortly after I moved to D.C. in 1985, I continued to paint a little bit. But just before I left Pittsburgh to move to Washington, D.C., I had discovered the work of Betty Saar and Joseph Cornell, who were both mixed media artists. And so the shift really happened just before, you know, I mean, well, just after I moved to D.C., where I started really wanting to make three-dimensional works using a variety of objects and constructed objects. But I think the way I approached my work and the content started to shift when I moved to a particular neighborhood that was sort of a depressed neighborhood. And, you know, a few of the young men there were killed while I was living there. And I think it made me really start to look at our society and what was going on in politics at the time. And that's when the shift kind of came to more, overtly political thinking.
There is a whole area of the show in Kansas City that have what I don't know what you call them. I'll call them gun pieces. And mm-hmm. These are works owned by the Belger. They are being loaned out a lot these days to museums across the country. And I would think you probably have people telling you that they are timely, but I'm curious about your thoughts on that because you made them in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because in the 90s, I was really, really, you know, looking at what was going on politically because I live in Washington, D.C. You can't escape politics here. It's you know, it's the nation's capital. It's the center of the political, you know, world here in our country. And I have always been aware of the disparities in, you know, economic disparity, all kinds of things, you know, and I think that it's really coming to the forefront now. But even back then, I was thinking about these things and, you know, examining the gun violence that was happening in the community and why it was happening, you know. And so the guns were just sort of a metaphor for trying to, the way I did it, each gun has the name of a freedom fighter or a person who was really fighting to create a just society. And so it was a metaphor for fighting back against all of this, you know, the injustice. And so the guns, to me, have always been relevant. They never were not relevant. What's been going on has been building for a long time.
Yeah, like you've got a gun etched with Harriet Tubman's name on it.
Right.
There is also a small piece. I'm not quite sure how to describe it, and I'm going to let you do that. It's called mm-hmm. Baby's First Gun, and it is mm-hmm. super haunting. And I wonder if you can talk about it a little bit, describe it, and I'll jump in with you. But, yeah, mm-hmm. I'd love to hear you describing it.
Okay, yeah, that's a really, really tiny piece. And during the time when I was making that gun series, I came across a little tin toy gun, you know, in a little junk store that had, it was like, I guess, a little cap gun, and it said ABC on it. Like, you know, like they put ABC on a lot of children's toys.
Yeah,
right?
Like for someone who's learning their ABCs.
It's who's learning their ABCs. So it was like,
but also getting a gun.
Right. The most surreal, crazy thing to have ABC on the side of a little toy gun. And to me, that spoke volumes about the way our society basically trains young people to think in terms of wanting guns. But when you think about that, you know, a gun is an object designed to kill. It kills. It kills whether animals, it kills people. But you are training young people to the mindset to kill something. And that's mind-boggling to me. So what I did was I took that little gun, and I took a fabric that's called mattress ticking, where, you know, you see it in, when you look, some mattresses, especially older ones, have this kind of striped, it's like canvas, but it's got stripes. Sometimes it's blue. In this particular case, the swath of fabric was yellow and white, and it reminded me of something that would be in a child's crib. And so I created a little, like, sort of base for the gun to sit on, and then the box that I found to put it in, I painted it pastel colors like you would see, you know, on children's clothing, or like somebody might paint their daughter's wall a pretty pastel pink or their son's room a pretty pastel blue. Well, the box was made of colors like that, and on the outside, there was sort of a tug-of-war going on between a donkey and an elephant. But it was done like in a childlike style. But of course, it represented Democrats and Republicans
fighting about the laws around guns.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, there's one element of this that I believe was in this piece. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a fortune out of a fortune cookie. And it says something like, society prepares the crime, the criminal commits it.
That's exactly what it said. And I got it out of a fortune cookie. Around that time. So it's funny how the synchronicity of things happens. It's like, you know, when I'm creating something, sometimes it's like all the little things that come to me seem to be the things that will, you know, are what I need to complete the piece and the idea that I'm trying to convey. And I do believe that, you know, there's some truth to that, that society, you know, prepares the crime and the criminal commits it. I mean, you make guns available to people who are unstable and things happen.
You know, as I mentioned earlier, the Belgers have been collecting your work for a long time. And I understand that you have sort of forged over the years a real back and forth kind of relationship with Dick Belger, a collector of yours. And one of, again, like, these are just stories that I have heard, and you can tell me if you don't remember him this way, but one of the works in the show used to be flat, I guess, and then you offhandedly told him that you'd always envisioned it popping out like on a springy wire mattress?
Oh, that's called Ogun's Bed. And what happened was I had made a, for an outdoor installation, I had, you know, created this sort of flat quilt-like thing made of, like, I can't even describe what it is, but I guess you would use it as, like, metal fencing to keep chickens in or something. And I had created a quilt, but between the two like pieces of metal, I embedded like tools in between it, like found rusty objects in between, and then I wired both sheets of this stuff together, and then it sort of like laid there flat on the floor, kind of like a quilt. And one day I mentioned to Dick Belger, oh, you know, because sometimes you'll make a piece and you'll revisit it, and you realize what you could have done to make it like even better. So I had mentioned to him, yeah, you know, I really wish I had one of those old mattresses with springs, and then that could be bent over it like a real quilt, you know, to make it look like the quilt on a bed, and so I could have an actual whole metal bed, right? So I don't know how long later it was, Dick told me that he was going between Kansas City and another city that he would visit, I think, in Missouri. And he found by the roadside a spring, one of the very kinds of, you know, mattress springs that I wanted. And so he brought it back to the Belger. And so one day when I was having a show down there, shortly after he first collected all the work, because they were going to have a big show, I got a chance to actually put the quilt that I'd already made onto the metal bed. So then I finally got the piece exactly the way I wanted.
What has it been like to see all this work together in one place? Is it like Renee Stout, This Is Your Life?
Exactly. And what I like about it, because Dick Belger, you know, got the idea that when he collects an artist, he just doesn't want like, you know, a few pieces here and there. When he likes an artist, what he wanted to do is collect their work extensively from different periods, because that way, when people view an artist's work, they get to see the evolution from an earlier period of time and how the artist has evolved over several bodies of work. And I think that's a brilliant idea for a collector to do. And so I feel like the way my work has been seen at the Belger is the best possible way that my work can be seen, because it varies so much from, you know, different media, different subject matter. Sometimes it looks like it was made by a million people.
Renee Stout, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Renee Stout's Church of the Crossroads is still up at the Belger, but tonight's Art Walk for First Fridays is your last chance to see it. So if you haven't and you want to, go now. Up next, the story of a soul band. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. There's a new soul band getting serious buzz in Kansas City music circles, even if the rest of the city is still catching on. The band is called The Freedom Affair. They play pretty often at the Ship in the West Bottoms, where people hit the dance floor hard every time the rhythm section gets going and the three powerhouse vocalists, all women, start belting out songs. So before we get their story, let's hear some music. This is Rise Up. This is Rise Up by The Freedom Affair, and now I want to dance. Thanks a lot, guys. I guess I'll do my job. I'm here with one of the singers, Misha Roberts, and a drummer who started the group, Dave Brick. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
So first of all, I want to hear a little bit about how each of you came to your interest in soul music. Misha, let's start with you.
Okay. So soul is a part of my soul, I think. I've been singing in the church since I was very tiny. Probably 11 years old is when I started singing in church. But my first song I ever sung was a Whitney Houston song called The Greatest Love of All. And so...
What year is this?
That was...
But you were singing it. Like, how old were you?
1988. I was 8 years old, so...
Oh, yeah, man.
It's been a long time.
I was singing that one in the shower, but no one would have wanted to hear my version. Tell me about what prompted you. Where did you sing that song?
So, The Greatest Love of All was the first time I ever sang on stage, and it was for my second grade talent show at in elementary school. I was terrified, and I didn't even want to try out. I had waited to the last day to try out for the talent show, and I begged my mom, okay, Mom, will you please go with me? It was the last day, last hour, last, and we made it to the audition, and I sang, of course, on stage for the first time. It was very cool.
What was cool about it? Like, what made up for all the terror you felt ahead of time?
I think, you know, as a singer, even as an adult singer, I like to see people's reactions whenever you give them a part of your soul. And so I think that was one of the things that I held on to, is watching people's faces react when you sing a song or share with them a part of you. So
Chris, Dave, for you, tell me about your history with soul music. When did you get into soul music?
I was around 13 years old. I grew up listening to music. I always loved music. But until I was in middle school, I was just listening to rock music, pop music, things like that. I was in a band. I had already been playing drums for a little while. I was in a band with some friends. And an older friend of ours who actually played bass in my brother's group, I remember the moment, introduced us to Roy Ayers. Roy Ayers' Ubiquity. We were in his buddy's Grand Wagoneer, and we heard this song, Pretty Brown Skin. My buddy and I just looked at each other like, what is this? I want more of that. And that started a whole windfall of, you know, searching for records, searching for more soul music, and just digging, and building up a collection of as much soul music as I could find.
So with some backgrounds from the church and some backgrounds from digging for records, the members of this band love soul music. But what is the story behind the band? And I want to hear it first from your vantage point, Dave. I mean, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I grew up here in Kansas City, but I moved back about a year and a half ago. For the past, 13, 14 years, I was playing in a funk band in the San Francisco Bay Area called the Grease Traps. The guitarist of my band told me to reach out to this record label, Sunflower Soul, in Kansas City to find people to play with. That was the biggest thing. The biggest reason I didn't want to move from the Bay Area was my band. I could do everything else I do out there that I loved out there here, but I was going to miss that band. So I reached out to Sunflower Soul and said, hey, I'm looking for like-minded musicians, people to play with in Kansas City. I'm moving there. I'm in this band, the Grease Traps, blah, blah, blah. 20 minutes later, Chris Hazleton emails back and says, hey, I know the Grease Traps. I have your 45. Let's get together. So we got together a few times, and I had in my head this idea of three female singers fronting a group. It's a sound that I love. There's so many groups that do that, or something similar to that. I wanted to do it.
Well, so Misha, as one of those singers, how did you find out about this project and what caught your interest?
Okay, so I am a full-time singer in the city, so that's what I do. And I had been playing with a group on a third Thursday at the Nelson Atkins Museum, where they showcase different bands every month, once a month. And Chris Hazleton and I, who also contacted Dave, we were on a gig together, and he came to me after that gig and said, you know, I have an idea for this group. Would you be interested? And so I said, absolutely. And from there on, myself and Paula Saunders and Seiko Groves have been the three women that have fronted the band.
Can you tell me about the dynamic between the three of you? Because it seems like you guys do almost like some mind reading in terms of like anticipating what the other's going to do. That might just be a lot of rehearsing at work, but I'm curious about the rapport there.
Okay, so Seiko and I have been friends for almost 20 years. We met in college, and so we've done so many things together. And Paula, I think she's just amazing. So I think that's why we're a great match for the three of us, and we get along. And so what you see on stage is very pure and very real. So
when the songs that I have gotten to like really listen to, like in my headphones, you guys are coming out with a record soon, but it's not out yet. So what I've been able to hear is just what you do at shows and what like gets kind of preserved from that. Mm-hmm. And the songs Rise Up and You Can't Keep a Good Woman Down seem very much about like sisterhood.
Yes, they are very much. We now the times and stuff are very political and things that are going on. We try to reach a different crowd, the crowd of people. And
can you explain what you mean by that?
Go ahead,
Are you
Dave.
Looking at me? I think so. I wrote Rise Up, and I was embracing my inner feeling of sisterhood in that. But I wanted to write songs that, you know, from the perspective of showing love and supporting each other. And oftentimes we hear people talk about brothers and sisters. No one really says sisters and brothers. So I just had that in my head of putting the lady first in this song and showing love for everyone really, but women first, putting them first in that sentence. So with all of our music, it's all just kind of organically come together where we're all writing tunes. We're very collaborative in the way that we write tunes. But it's all coming from, you know, from our souls. You know, true soul music, a greatest expression of soul music is, you know, an honest representation of someone's feelings.
This is dance music. I mean, that
well, right. It
undeniable.
Is.
Undeniable. And I'm curious, like, there is a whole tradition of, like, the political dance song. What's going on there? It feels like if you put with different rhythm, like the same political lyrics, you might be like sitting there crying into your drink or something, but there's some different vibe that happens.
Right. Well, you know, along with this idea of soul music being what we feel, what represents us, where we're coming from. Yeah. We have these feelings of unrest or of you know, wanting to challenge, speak truth to power. But we also, you know, we like to party. And we're trying to be positive about all of it, right? We're trying
dance
to
dance it off, kind
of. Yeah, I'm not trying to commiserate with these folks. I'm trying to spread love. I think that's what we're trying to do as a band, is spread love, a positive message, and really, ultimately, hope that we can at least spark thought, or in the best case scenario, action, to make the world a better place.
Misha, what do you feel when you're like singing these songs and there are crowds of people getting sweaty and dancing? And
what do I feel?
Yeah.
Well, when you can sing a song and make someone move or feel an emotion, like, to me, that's one of the best feelings ever, is to know that you can touch someone in that sort of aspect, respect. It's deep.
Well, we're gonna go out pretty soon on a song called You Can't Keep a Good Woman Down. What can you tell me about that song?
That's Paula's song.
Yeah, she's a soloist on that one. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But
Cole wrote that.
Cole wrote that. Yeah. One of the guitar players. And you can't keep a good woman down. I know that.
Well, the song is starting to play, and you know, just as people are listening, what do you think they're going to hear? What do you want to point out?
The soulfulness of Paula Saunders. Google her.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's what she always says. Google me, Paula Saunders. Yeah, yeah, all these, everyone in this band is so talented and has such a great perspective to bring to the music. It's, you know, Cole can write a song that Paula can then take.
Yes.
And elevate so much. It's so special.
Well, our time is up. Misha Roberts, Dave Brick, with us from The Freedom Affair. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Freedom Affair's next show is at The Ship in the West Bottoms at the end of the month, January 30th, a school night, a Wednesday, probably worth it. Admission's $5. You can keep up with the band's news on their Facebook page. And that's a wrap for today and the week here on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Chris Young, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. We get help from intern Salisa Kalakal, and our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Our theme music, which you are not hearing right now, is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend. Oh, no.